It's 9:06. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. Well, this hour it's all things political as we take a look back at the week's past political news. Anyone can join the discussion by calling us at 800-486-8655, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. My guest this hour is David J. Leneux, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Alabama. Good morning, Professor Leneux, and welcome to the program.
Good morning. Nice to be with you.
Well, first of all, I would like to hear from you. What did you think was, what was your favorite political story of the last week? Which story, and if it may not be the same, which story do you think had the was the most significant politically?
Well, I think the most significant politically was probably what came out of the Senate Finance Committee and the rejection of the public option. I think that was probably the biggest story in terms of where we stand on health care and how that affects President Obama's ultimate success. My favorite story, just because it was a great microcosm of how silly media stories can get and how they can get blown out of proportion, was the Olympics. The fact that President Obama went there to push for Chicago Olympics and suddenly became a big political issue back home, to the point where it split liberals and conservatives, and there were some conservatives who seemed to be cheering the fact that the United States lost the Olympic Games because it meant Obama lost.
Yeah, there were quite a few posts on conservative websites. The Weekly Standard, their big headline right after it happened was Chicago loses,
right.
Cheers erupt at Weekly Standard. There's video on the internet of dancing and screaming and shouting after the news was announced at a some conservative summit. And then there were others in the Republican Party who were warning people, hey, you know, it would have been great if Chicago got in the Olympics. This is about America. But Democrats were jumping on this, saying, you know, first it's Rush Limbaugh saying, you know, we hope Obama fails. And now you guys are saying, yay, we lost the Olympics. That makes Obama look bad. Are you, you know, why do you hate America? Kind of turning the tables on the Republicans,
right,
considering some of the things that were said during the Bush administration.
Well, it really shows what a lightning rod President Obama is, and how even things that seemed like they would unite the country turn into divisive issues. And, you know, you can certainly imagine what the Republicans would have said if, under similar circumstances, somebody like John Kerry had cheered the fact that America lost the Olympics. So it was a kind of strange situation. I think that, you know, cooler heads started to prevail later on, and people, you know, Republicans started to say, let's back off from this. This is not making us look good.
There was a lot of political news involving the GOP last week. Kind of a dust up between the people who support John McCain or who supported him in the last election, and former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin supporters led by Rush Limbaugh. What was that all about? I read pieces about this, and I was thinking, you know, well, what is the point of this?
Well, it's clear that there are some people from the McCain campaign who are still very angry at Sarah Palin for the way she conducted herself, and partly blames Governor Palin for some of the problems they had. Now, honestly, I think there's a certain amount of rationalization there. I mean, Sarah Palin was largely going by script, especially from the beginning when she ran for vice president, when she was nominated. And I think you get a lot of people who ran McCain's campaign and have a lot to answer for because the campaign did not go very well, who are now trying to push a lot of that on to Sarah Palin. And it's compounded by the anger they had that she kind of went rogue and didn't entirely play by their script. But a lot of it's rationalization, too.
Well, it should be interesting to see how this plays out. Some people are suggesting that John McCain will run again in 2012. What do you think?
I would be astounded if John McCain ran again in 2012, to be honest with you. And I'd be even more astounded if the Republicans turned to him. I mean, he was never a choice of the Republican base. They went with him as, I think, the lesser of all evils. And he did not really acquit himself terribly well in the campaign. He didn't debate well. He didn't stay on message well. His choice of Sarah Palin seemed almost impetuous. I can't imagine that McCain would want to go through that again, and I can't imagine even more that the Republicans would think that he would be a winner 2 years from now in a way that he clearly wasn't last year.
Meanwhile, there are some gubernatorial elections that are being watched very closely. The one in New Jersey seems to be turning a little bit in the favor of the Democrats. Meanwhile, in Virginia, the Democratic candidate seems to be in a little trouble. Are these elections going to be bellwethers for what we're likely to see in 2010?
Well, they're certainly going to be bellwethers for where the president stands right now, where the Democrats stand. I think that right now they're hoping the Democrats are to get a split here, that if they can somehow pull off New Jersey, and you know, there have been a lot of bad stories about the Republican candidate there that have helped the Democrat side. If they can pull off New Jersey, not lose too badly in Virginia, then they'll probably call it a draw and say that it had nothing to do with President Obama. But, you know, midterm elections are always, to some extent, a referendum on the president. Local issues matter, and I know there's the whole issue there in Virginia about the Republican candidate's old statements about women and such. But really, if you look at midterm elections, people are looking at the incumbent party and saying, "Am I happy with where they are?" And the fact that the incumbent party in both Virginia and New Jersey also happen to be Democrat, I think, even increases that.
Well, gubernatorial elections tend to be about taxes, whether they're property taxes or income taxes, and a lot of states are in trouble financially and have had to either raise taxes or find other what are euphemistically called revenue enhancers, and there could be a number of governors in trouble across the country, both Republican and Democrat.
It's a bad time to be a governor during a recession, and because a lot of what happens to states. States don't have a lot of influence. The national economy tanks, and it drags everybody down with them. And if you look really at the gubernatorial popularity ratings across the country, they're down from where they were a year or two ago. And I think going into 2010, depending on where the economy is a year from now, you could have a lot of governors in fairly deep trouble. Although at least if the economy is bad, the Republicans can try to deflect blame toward Washington. The Democrats won't have that option.
800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. That's the toll-free number to use to join our discussion of all things political for this Monday morning, the 5th of October, 2009. You can also send us an email. Here's the address, talk@wpr.org. Well, Professor Leno, let's go back to healthcare for just a moment. You started us off with that as probably the most significant political news story of the past week. The Senate Finance Committee basically rejected the public option. Where does that leave those Democrats who are really convinced that that's the only way out of this mess?
Well, it leaves them having to still make the case to the American people to put pressure on Congress, which they haven't, I think, done very effectively. It does not look like, it seems almost certain, in fact, that the Democrats will not get 60 votes for a clear, unadulterated public option. If Senator Baucus is not going to go for it and Senator Conrad's not going to go for it, you're not going to get to 60. It looks like zero Republicans will. So now the question is, what do they do strategically? Do they water it down, try to come up with something that they can claim is a public option of sorts, bring the last few Democrats on board and pass it 60-40? Do they try to get some victories in some other Senate committees to push the issue? Do they consider the reconciliation option, basically to put it through on a budgeting bill and require only 50 votes and 51 and cancel the chance for a Republican filibuster, which obviously would be fraught with a number of political risks? Do they hope for a little help in the conference committee when the House and Senate bills get reconciled there? There are a lot of different options, but this is, I think, pretty disappointing so far for the Democrats.
Well, it just seems like they can't get together and agree on anything. And the suggestion that somehow or other these healthcare cooperatives equals the same effect as the public option. When you do any kind of research on it at all, there were a number of stories on NPR over the weekend including interviews with people who were in some of these. I think there's one of them out in Washington State someplace, or Oregon, that they're really basically nonprofit insurance companies, which we already have.
Right. I mean, it clearly is not the public option the way that anybody defined the public option 6 months ago. And you're right. I mean, a lot of insurance companies are currently nonprofits, and it would be quite possibly a great boon to them. You know, things like entities like Blue Cross could redefine themselves as nonprofits, and I think in some cases they already are, and they could play a part in that, and so you end up back to square one. Now, the question really, I think, is with the president. He hasn't taken a lot of leadership on this so far. He started to in the last couple of weeks, and now the question is, what does he want to fight for? Does he want to go to the mat for the full public option, try to twist the arms of the Senate, and see if he can get his way back to 60, maybe with a few compromises, maybe push for reconciliation? Or is he now going to go for something like co-ops or a trigger or something that allows him to claim, we've got a kind of sort of public option there, so you kind of sort of got what I promised?
Well, let's talk about reconciliation for just a moment. What's the that was how I believe both of the Bush tax cuts got passed, was through reconciliation. There have been a number of times when that's been used. What's the upside and the downside for the Democrats if they decide to go that way in the Senate?
Well, the upside, of course, is that you only need 51 votes, and so the Republicans can't stop it with a filibuster if they, you know, get a Democrat or two to go along with them. So if they want to play hardball, they could try to push it through that way, and they could conceivably get a real public option. The House would already vote for it. Obama could sign it, and the upside is obviously that Barack Obama kept his promise, and he looks strong and effective. The downside is what it will do to relations in the Senate. I mean, this is really obviously a very strong, hot-button issue, and the Republicans are talking about this like it's another nuclear option, that if the Democrats do this, if the Democrats force health care reform down their throats this way, that the relationship in the Senate will never be the same, the Republicans will become a lot more obstructionist, and it will look like the Democrats, after talking about George Bush for 8 years, strong-arming everybody, turn out to be hypocrites.
Okay, but let's talk about that for just a moment, because I'm trying to think of something that President Obama has proposed since he took office that Republicans have supported in the Senate.
I think that would be nothing.
How could they be more obstructionist than they have been?
There are delaying tactics that could be used, and you know that could simply slow down the business of the Senate in a number of other different ways. I think that's a valid point that the Republicans, because they really haven't played ball with Obama before, have a much harder time claiming that that there's going to be some cost to him for doing this. I think the real potential cost, if it happens, it would be the public opinion cost if the media decide that this is really a strong arm action, that this is, you know, the imperial presidency coming back and Bush too. But honestly, my sense is that the benefit would be greater for Obama to look successful and strong than the harm of looking like a thug, a hardball player.
Well, you have some individuals who have basically come out and said, look, we don't care. We don't want Obama to get a win on health care. So no matter what he comes up with, we're going to oppose it. And for the same reason that those same Republicans opposed health care efforts by the Clintons back in the 90s. It's not a question of health care policy. It's about politics. So if the Democrats use what the Republicans are referring to as this nuclear option, reconciliation, they can then continue to paint the Republicans as the party of no.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and they'll have the benefit of having succeeded, and President Obama will have the benefit of having actually delivered on a promise that he made. you know, the other risk, of course, of this this nuclear option is, in addition to the question of how the Republicans will take it, and of course your point's well taken that the Republicans, you know, have pretty much been blocking everything anyway, is what's going to happen with people like Conrad and Baucus and some of the more moderate to conservative Democrats. How are they going to react to that, and will that poison their relationship with the president? And also, will it create costs for the Democrats in the 2010 elections with some of these moderate senators and members of the House? Again, my personal sense is that the risk is greater even for the moderate Democrats if President Obama looks like a failure than if he succeeds on this, even though conservatives and moderate Democrats voted against it.
Yeah, when we come back, we have to take a break, but when we come back, I want to talk about what you would see as a good Republican strategy going forward, because it seems to me that there are tremendous risks for both the Democrats and the Republicans, regardless of who wins which vote. I think it would make an interesting discussion for us to talk about what the best strategy would be for the GOP going forward on this, and maybe contrast that if we can with what's happening now. And there are probably some other things. Plus, I'm sure there are some people who would like to join in this debate with some suggestions as well. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. You can also send an email. The address is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 24 minutes after 9 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Here's what's coming up a little bit later on the Ideas Network. After 3 on Here on Earth, Gene Faraca talks to a Catholic preacher who teaches the dances of universal peace and other forms of prayer and ritual drawn from the wisdom traditions. That is after 3, Gene Faraca here on the Ideas Network. Hey, good news, everybody. Normally our fall pledge drive is 12 days long, but you've already helped us shorten this one by 2 whole days. Hooray. For every 700 pledges, we'll take another day off. And we're 2 days into that already, and we have 1,647 pledges. We need another 453 to take off another day. So thanks to you, we've already shortened our fall pledge drive by 2 days. Let's make it 3. Go to WPR.org and make your pledge right now. This hour is all things political, and my guest and I are discussing all sorts of political stuff, and you can join us at 800-486-8655 or talk@WPR.org. My guest this hour is David Leneau, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Alabama. We were talking about health care and the possible risks to both Republicans and Democrats, depending on how things go here over the next few weeks and months and looking ahead to the 2010 elections. If you were giving advice to Republican strategists, what would you say that they've been doing right and doing wrong, and where would you suggest that they go next?
Well, I think the big problem for the Republicans right now is they're playing out of the 1993 playbook. Their interpretation of 93 is that they fought Clinton, they made him look weak, they beat him on health care, they made him look like a failure, and the Democrats took a dive in 94, and the Republicans took over. And, I mean, there's some validity to that. I think the risk that they're taking right now is it's not 1993 anymore. People are feeling far more insecure. They don't enjoy the back and forth politics of this because they see times as a great deal more dire now. The economy's tanking, healthcare is exerting a lot more stress on people's lives. People are losing their homes, their incomes, and so I think the stakes are perceived to be a whole lot higher here now than they were in 1993. And if you look at the polls, Obama's starting to drop a little bit, although he's still well above 50%. The Democratic congressional leaders have dropped a bit, although they're still in the mid-30s, which for Congress is not terrible. But the one thing you notice there is the Republicans have not risen. So this strategy has not made them more popular. So if I were advising Republicans, I would tell them it's not 1993. and that the 2010 election is not going to be 1994, and that if they, you know, that they should try at least to look like they're working with President Obama, get him to compromise if they can, and be able to claim that they kept, you know, big government down, they kept big government on a leash, and so that they were effective. And then, obviously, as it always has been, whatever the economy turns out to be in 2010 is going to dictate the result of that election anyway.
Well, it certainly hasn't helped their cause that some of their prominent spokespeople have said things like, God help us if the government ever gets its hands on Medicare.
Well, there's no question that the Republicans need to figure out who's going to deliver their message. I mean, they have kind of let themselves be led by some people whose business is really first and foremost to entertain and get ratings and shock and titillate rather than to make policy. And so Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck and even Sarah Palin, who's kind of moved into that realm, have been some of their leading spokespersons, and people who could be more helpful have either faded into the background or haven't really pushed themselves into the foreground enough. You know, John McCain's tried a little bit, but he's damaged goods. The Republicans need to find spokespeople who sound statesmanlike, who sound like they're serious people. Even if they oppose the president, they have to sound like they're not bomb throwers.
Well, here's a headline from a story on the Politico website, GOP leaders to steal back off, and this refers to a story that congressional leaders in the Republican caucus had a private meeting with the Republican National Committee chairman and told him to quit making policy. I mean, he came out with this, Senior Citizens Healthcare Bill of Rights. They're annoyed that the leader of their political machine, if you want to call it that, has been coming out with policy statements, and they told him to stop doing that. Well, who gets to decide policy for the Republican Party? I mean, who makes their decisions for them?
Well, that's a really good question. They need to coordinate that better. Ideally, those decisions should be coming from their congressional leadership and maybe from some of the more successful state governors. But the message ought to be coordinated, and Michael Steele ought to be coordinating with them. I mean, the Steele choice has really been a train wreck from the beginning. I mean, Steele has always been a little more moderate than the base of the Republican Party, and he made a few mistakes at the beginning. But I think, honestly, if it has to be a choice between Michael Steele carrying the message and Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck, the Republicans are probably better off with Steele, but they're far better off if Boehner and McConnell and Steele would get on the same page, push their own message, and hopefully maybe exert a little more influence on the agenda than some of these talk radio hosts.
Well, meanwhile, you have the Democrats seemingly once again forming up for another circular firing squad on health care and perhaps some other issues as well. They haven't been able to really capture the public imagination with the things that they're trying to do.
Well, the Democrats are the Democrats, of course, and so there's always going to be that problem. I mean, they are a broader base party than the Republicans. Ultimately, if you look at the Republicans, they're only about three or four that could even be considered on the moderate side of the political spectrum, whereas the Democrats in the Senate have moderates, they have a few conservatives, and that makes it a little tougher. But part of this, I think, you have to lay at the feet of the president. He really, I think, let the health care debate kind of go on without him for far too long a period. He really should have tried to set the agenda on this, and there should have been an Obama plan going in. Now, the Congress might have done a lot of different things with it. They might have chopped it up. He would certainly have been taking a risk doing that. But I think in politics, you always look better if you're the one trying to set the agenda than if you're the one trying to clean up after things go haywire.
Well, we have some callers who want to join us, so let's go to the phones, and we'll start with James in Galena.
Hi. Interesting conversation. I was a directing business representative for 30-odd years. I'm 74 years old and retired now. I serviced 38 different corporations in six different states. And I can tell you that we've, out of the 38 big corporations, and there's minor plants, and some of them had six or eight plants, the majority of them are getting out of the insurance field. Some of them have moved to Mexico because of the insurance cost. The insurance cost has went from $700 an employee up to almost $1,500-$1,600 per employee and family over these years. The basic thing, the problem with the Republican Party is my problem is if you do nothing, it's just going to continue to rise, and these people are going to be left on their own because the corporations can't handle it. John Deere right now has a suit against John Deere here in Dubuque, right 12 miles from us, from the retirees, because they're cutting the retirees' benefits on them, and that's going to happen across this country. One of the reasons I think that Obama's poll figures have dropped over the past 6 or 7 months, and I'm a Democrat, I'm dissatisfied with him because he's not doing a decent job, but because I don't think they're forceful enough in their positions, and I think they ought to get out and push it more and get a program and put it together. And I can honestly tell you, if you don't have a public option, some competition for these insurance companies, you're just giving the insurance companies a kiss on the mouth because they're going to continue to increase their rates at 8-9% a year. Right now they got about a 36-37% profit margin. By the time they sell it, so it gets to the CEO who's making $30 million to $100 million a year. And if you don't change that policy, this country's in major, major problems.
James, thanks for the call. Professor, do you think how common do you think James' point of view is?
Well, I think it makes a very interesting point. And honestly, I was waiting to see whether the business community was going to split on this. I mean, obviously, the health insurance industry has a big stake in the status quo or in something that at least keeps the money directed toward them. But there is a lot of industry in America that is getting absolutely killed by these healthcare costs, is having to get out of the business of healthcare entirely, is suffering from the fact that their employees are not able to deal with their healthcare problems. And I thought there would actually be a split. I thought that some of the business community would come around and more vocally support the idea of a public option just so they could get themselves out of the business of healthcare and all the rising costs that entails. So it's been a little bit of a surprise that that hasn't happened. On his other point, I think he's also absolutely correct. People respond positively to parties that have an agenda. They responded that way to President Bush. He was, people forget now, but for the first 3 or 4 years of his presidency, and obviously 9/11 had a role in that, he was very popular because he was seen as a take-charge president. Now, of course, as his failures mounted, that fell apart. But the Democrats could use some of that.
Well, one of the criticisms of the bill that came out of Senate Finance was that it was basically written by a former insurance company executive, and it would do nothing to stop the bankruptcies and things that are caused by medical costs and so forth. If the Democrats come up with a bill that looks like it was crafted by the insurance industry, I would think that they're in big trouble.
If the Democrats come up with a bill that requires everybody to buy insurance, but doesn't cap the costs, doesn't stop the companies from cutting people off when they get sick, or by looking into their past records and finding that they didn't report having a hangnail once, and cutting them off from their insurance when they need it most. If the Democrats pass a bill where the insurance companies keep getting the money and the service keeps getting stays bad and people keep losing their homes and their income and keep going bankrupt from this, the Democrats are going to pay an enormous price.
Let's see. Let's take a call from Mike in South Milwaukee next. Good morning, Mike.
Hello. I agree with the last caller, Nina. I am a...
Uh-oh. Mike, your cell is bad there. Call us back. We'll put you right back on, but you need to get to either a landline or find a better cell area. Let's take Ann in Madison. Good morning,
Hello.
Ann.
Hi. I agree with the last caller completely, and I do disagree with your guess that the public is not letting Congress know how they feel about a single-payer system, actually. Many polls have shown that's what they want. It's the only system that avoids skimming off profits. by the world's only health for profit insurance industry. And when the bank bailout, when the first bank bailout that was engineered by former Goldman Sachs Treasury Secretary Paulson happened, I understood that, and in fact John Conyers' office told me, Representative Conyers, that about a third of the way through that plan, something like 250,000 American citizens had called to protest that bailout. So what American citizens who are not sending checks for $100,000 to their members of Congress are doing is not being covered by most of the press, by most of the broadcast media. It's just not being talked about. And I agree, if we are forced to buy insurance and there are no controls in this unregulated society on the companies that have let people die rather than, you know, than have fewer profits, we're going to be getting into a pickle we won't be able to get out of. This will be enshrining the industry that denies people health care and gouges them on their policies. So I just think what's going on, if President Obama hadn't gotten so much money from the healthcare industry, he'd be way out front, but he surrounded himself with Wall Streeters and corporate executives, and he has to be blamed for that.
Ann, thanks for the call. Professor?
With respect to your caller, I think the American public is a bit more ambivalent than she suspects. If you look at the polls, you do see a significant support for a public option, although it often depends on the way you ask the question. And what the Republicans have been a little bit effective at is scaring people, and especially scaring senior citizens. Senior citizens, of course, already are covered by Medicare, and that's imperfect, and you have the problem with prescription drugs and the donut hole and all of that. But I think they have been effectively scared into thinking that if we move toward a public option, where's the money going to come from? It's going to have to come from cutting Medicare. Now, that's almost certainly not true, but they've been scared effectively into thinking that. So you really have these different constituencies rather than sort of a country as a whole thinking a certain way. You have senior citizens who, in a sense, have got theirs and are worried about losing it. You have people who have pretty good insurance, or at least they think they do, through their employers, and worry that they're going to have to share with others, and that their experience is going to decline. And then you have people who are more worried about it, who are more vulnerable, and they're obviously very strong supporters. And then obviously you have the ideological angle too, where conservatives feel one way and liberals feel another. But you really have a number of different constituencies here that are not all of the same mind.
Well, and President Obama has been taking some heat from the left wing of his own party. I mean, he has to be a little careful about his own base, does he not?
Well, he does. There are a number of liberals in the House, in fact, a critical mass of them, who claim that they will vote against anything that does not include a clear, honest public option. And if they kept their word on that, in combination with Republicans, they would be enough to defeat the bill in the House. Now, my guess is that unless President Obama gives them something that's absolutely awful, something that basically just feeds the insurance companies and gives the people practically nothing, that they will probably sign on to ultimately whatever health care bill we get simply because they don't want to undermine their president. But there's a lot of significant anger there, and if you look into 2010 and 2012, the other thing is, you have to worry about your base, the people who actually do the campaign organization and work for you, the people who got Obama elected, the people who got him past Hillary Clinton in the primaries. If those people decide they're alienated, they sit on their hands in 2010 and 2012, it's not going to be a good year for the Democrats.
Well, I think, yeah, that's exactly what I've been hearing and reading, and that would be a major worry for Democratic strategists. Well, where the phones are starting to really light up, we're going to take a quick break. And when we return, we'll have some phone calls and further discussion. It's all things political here on the Ideas Network. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This is Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:42. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this morning. Coming up next hour, are American schools adequately preparing future generations to participate in the country's democratic system? Well, my guest gives schools a failing grade for readying the leaders of tomorrow. We'll talk about the importance of language education in a democracy coming up next hour here on the Ideas Network. This hour, it's all things political. We're discussing the political news of the last week, and as has been the case pretty much every Monday, healthcare is dominating the discussion and will probably continue to do so, and, well, that's the way it goes. My guest today is David Leneau, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Alabama. Jan in Green Bay wants to join us next, and let's take that call. Jan, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Just fine. Go ahead.
Okay. First, I have a comment. If Senator Baucus had get out of bed with the health insurance industry, we would have had a public option because they are paying him well not to have one. And number two, the Republican Party is now the party of no. So what is their plan other than shooting down everything that comes through the Congress, especially on health care? And that's it. Thanks.
Well, I guess a couple of responses. The Republicans now are trying to claim that they are cobbling together a plan that's going to include tort reform that they claim will bring down the insurance rates, allowing people to buy insurance across state lines, and so creating greater competition that way. I mean, obviously, the Democrats' response to that is that you had 8 years to run with these ideas. What happened? So it does really seem like kind of a meager response to what the Democrats are doing. As for the, question about the comment about Senator Baucus, it does, I think, this whole debate throw into stark relief issues that we have with campaign contributions and the extent to which contributions influence members of Congress. And, we don't really have a good answer to that. There certainly is at least the appearance of a conflict of interest created, but we don't know the counterfactual. We don't know what Max Baucus would do if he had no insurance company contributions. I don't want to be overly cynical, but these things potentially do matter.
Oh well, I'll go ahead and be overly cynical because I'm a cynic. Interestingly enough, the Supreme Court is going to be making decisions about campaign financing. If the court watchers and prognosticators are correct, are going to make it more difficult to control corporate spending in elections and corporate contributions to candidates and so forth. Let me ask you this. As a political scientist, what do you, and this is coming completely out of the blue, but it's an issue that I don't think gets discussed enough. What do you think of the notion that corporations are people and have the same rights under the Constitution as you and me?
It's an odd notion, the idea that there's something called corporate free speech. I've obviously read all the works of the framers, and they could not have anticipated what we have now, so I don't want to speak for them. But very clearly, I thought free speech was a right that inhered in individuals, that people, certainly corporate leaders, have free speech. You and I have free speech. But the idea that, A, corporation has constitutional rights, and, B, that free speech can be fully interpreted as money, that money is the equivalent of speech, and to stop the spending of money is to stop free speech, I don't think that's by any means self-evident. In fact, the Canadian courts looked at that and went exactly in the opposite direction. So it's not clear to me why that is an obvious constitutional point. But I agree with the people who look at this that the Supreme Court probably will, given their conservative leanings, open the floodgates.
Yeah, I'm wondering how this is not interpreted as legislating from the bench, but that's probably another show. Let's take a call from Randy in Ripon. Hi, Randy.
Hi, I just tuned in. I heard you guys talking about the health care issues here, and I'm a self-employed carpenter. I'm 53 years old, and all of my life we've had a free market health care system, and to my understanding, Wisconsin has over 700 insurance companies supposedly competing against one another, but I don't see costs going down, and I've been quoted anywhere between $400 and $600 a month for health care. I can't afford it. And nonetheless, I've been turned down for pre-existing. So I've been living for the past, 30 years without health coverage. And there's just a part of me that just thinks this is somehow crossing a moral line here, that when I go to grocery stores and retail outlets and I see these cans for fundraisers for someone needing surgery, I just shake my head in disgust. We're the richest nation in the world, and this is what it's come down to. There's something totally immoral about this situation. And for me, it's just a deeply emotional, spiritual thing that we can't have a national health care system. And the naysayers say, it's just a terrible thing, it won't work, but then why are they so afraid of it, allowing it to happen? And I'll take any response off the air then. Thank you.
Randy, thanks for the call.
Yeah, I think very clearly this is another example of the failure of the Democrats to really control the debate. I mean, your caller is really the perfect example of somebody who clearly merits action on the part of the government. If you believe that, he's somebody who works hard, has his own business, and is just getting killed by these spiraling health care costs because he's not part of a big group that gets to that gets to negotiate with the health industry and bring the costs down. The Republicans have tried to say, well, the problem is that it's the poor, or it's going to go to Acorn, or that it's a problem is people overeat or people have bad dietary habits. When really, if the Democrats would concentrate on people, on telling the stories of people like your caller, people who work hard, who've done everything right, who are getting killed by these spiraling health care costs.
Well, and the debate is a lot easier if you don't feel bound by the truth.
Well, that's true.
Let's see. Let's take a call from Bruce in Milwaukee.
But I appreciate this. My question has to do with what is it worth doing? I've sent letters to local senators and congressmen and to others on the subject of the public option. Is it worth sending them any more paper on the subject? What should we do?
Well, I think if you want a public option, letting your members of the House and Senate know where you stand is extremely important. They do pay close attention to that. Now, once you've done it once or twice, certainly there's a law of diminishing returns there. But I think the other thing is that the people who oppose this, the town hall people, the Tea Party folks, they've been very out there and active and very good at getting attention. I think some of the things they do very effectively, they call radio talk shows, they write letters to the editor, they do things that make their numbers sound much greater than they actually are, and, politicians are superstitious. They don't want to lose the next election, and, they see something, a movement that seems to be growing, that seems to be vocal, that seems to be angry, and they respond to it. And there's been more of that on the anti-public option side than the pro side.
Yeah, I find some of this Tea Party stuff pretty interesting, considering that tax rates were much higher under Ronald Reagan.
That's true. I mean, well, of course, most voters unfortunately have a fairly short memory. But it's interesting too that even more than when Reagan was president, although that was toward the beginning of it, that increasing taxes now has become almost an issue that's off the table under all circumstances, and not just among the farthest and the far right, but almost among the median American voter. And that's another, I think, debate the Democrats, if they're going to be successful, have to start taking back. Not that they're going to be the party of raising taxes. Walter Mondale tried that and lost 49 states. But to start talking about taxes as an investment in the things that we want and need, and at least to try to bring back some balance to that debate.
Well, it's interesting you bring up Walter Mondale, because as people have studied that campaign, and we don't need to go back there necessarily, but you had two contrasting views. Walter Mondale said, okay, if you want this, here's what it's going to cost you, and you have to pay it. And Ronald Reagan saying it's morning in America. Well, what did we pick?
Well, and the problem, too, is that ultimately the secret to all this is that voters are sort of short-term rational. We all are. I mean, we all want We all want to get the most we can. We all want to pay the least for it. And we all want to hold government accountable when they don't give it to us. The problem is that's an equation that doesn't work.
Okay, but I want to bring that forward into the healthcare debate, because in a lot of cases, what the Democrats get stuck having to do is to explain a very complex issue that has a lot of permutations, and there's a lot of stuff here. And they have to say, okay, you know, this is going to cost this many dollars if we do this, but it's really necessary that we do it, and here's why. And there are all these reasons, and some of them are very complicated and hard to put on a bumper sticker, hard to shout on a radio show or shout at a meeting. And on the other hand, you have a lot of fear mongering and things like that. It makes the job of the Democrats here is much more difficult. They're trying to sell a plan that's very complicated, and admittedly, depending on how you put this in perspective or in context, is expensive. And on the other hand, you basically just have to try to stop it. And which one has the easier task?
Well, I mean, the disadvantage is always with the reformers, and especially with reformers who have a complicated task like that. I'm originally a Californian, and one of the things we know there from the state initiatives is it's always easier to scare voters into voting for something than it is to explain complicated arguments. But still, there are, I think, maybe not bumper sticker slogans, but there are relatively pithy statements that can be made about this that could and should have been made. And again, I do blame the president a little bit for letting the agenda get away from him early on and really not, you know, taking control of this, coming up with his own plan, defining it very clearly. And sure, the people would have come back and tried to scare people out of it, and they may well have succeeded anyway. But really, I think he let them get the drop on him.
Well, I know we have some more callers who really want to talk some more about health care, but we have neglected a number of other issues, including what's going on with Iran and the most recent developments in Afghanistan. And there are a number of foreign policy issues that the president needs to deal with here. Afghanistan seems to be a rather insoluble problem. Iran, the president basically said, look, you've got 2 weeks to make a decision here. But there was no or what on the end of that. It was basically you need to do this within 2 weeks. You need to let these inspectors in. But there was a what comes after that. OK, so if you don't, then what happens?
Yeah, I think those are two pretty big difficulties for him. Iran, I think. I think strategically he's probably doing the right thing here. You want to make threats, but you don't want to make threats that you then have to carry out. He can't say do this or we'll bomb your we'll bomb your installations. He's going to face the Republican cries that he's weak and ineffective and all of that. But I don't think people have an appetite for yet a third Middle Eastern war. To my mind, the bigger risk for him is Afghanistan, because a lot of these things, the failure in healthcare, the economy, Iran, Iraq, he will still get some benefit of the doubt next year, because people understand that those things started to go downhill under the previous administration. If he now doubles down in Afghanistan, which it looks like he may well do, that becomes his war. And, there are a lot of major powers that have tried to win in Afghanistan, and every one of them has been defeated. It's not to say that he will. It's not to say that it's an unwinnable war. But he will, if he moves any further on this, he will own that war, and it may well have the same effect on him that Iraq had on Bush.
We're coming down to the end of the program, the last minute and a half or so, so we're going to take another call, but I need you to try and be as brief as possible. Marion and Madison, you're on next. Good morning.
Good morning. I wanted you to talk about the profiteers in healthcare. And not just the insurance companies, which are profiteers, but the medical supply houses, the pharmaceuticals, the nursing home industry, the hospitals. I find it immoral that they are making millions, billions of dollars on other people's pain and suffering. I don't think this should be an industry that has huge profits. And that I find immoral. I think we need to look at this. Other countries don't allow those same kind of profits for their drug companies. And yet that happens right here in the United States. When are we going to look at the profits that are made on people's pain and suffering and the profits that are denying people coverage and killing them? There are 18,000 people that die every year for lack of health care, and that is obscene in this country. I am a registered nurse, and I do work in a hospital, and I find it obscene that there is so much profit-making in people's pain and suffering. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call, Mary. And, Professor, about 30 seconds to wrap this up.
I think that your caller makes a very good point. And, again, we talk about Democrats and the slogans they come up with. They should have said from the outset, there already is rationing. It's rationing by income. There already are waiting lists. The problem is, for a lot of people, those waiting lists are forever. Again, it's a matter of getting on top of the debate and appealing to people like your callers today, who I think see a very strong problem there but don't see any leadership.
Professor Lanoue, thank you for an interesting hour. Appreciate your time with us this morning.
Thank you.
David Lanoue is professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Alabama. This program was produced by Rhonda Fanning. Rob Schroeder handled the on-air production this morning. Stay tuned. More to come. We'll talk about language and democracy coming up after 10. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.